The deed of sale was 12 pages long. It listed the manor house with its 14 bedrooms and crumbling east wing. It listed 400 acres of farmland, two lakes, a stable of 8 horses, and one rather bad-tempered bull named Wellington. It listed the furniture, the silverware, the wine cellar, and the debts God. The debts, accumulated over 30 years by a man who had loved beautiful things far more than he had loved common sense. And then at the very bottom of the final page, in handwriting so small that the new Duke almost missed it entirely, there was one last line, one female, currently residing in the East Wing. Age 22. Status dependent. No arrangements have been made for her relocation. Edmund Ashford, the 6th Duke of Merindale, read the line twice. Then he looked up at his solicitor. What, he said quietly, is a dependent? His solicitor cleared his throat. A woman, Your Grace. She came with the property. Edmund looked back at the page. He had purchased a manor. He had purchased land, livestock, and an extraordinary amount of someone else's debt. Apparently, he had also purchased a woman. He assumed, not unreasonably, that she came with the furniture. He was wrong about almost everything. The carriage arrived at Ashford, or rather, at what was now Merindale Manor, though Edmund had not yet decided whether he would bother renaming it, on a gray Tuesday morning in October, when the sky looked exactly like an unpaid bill. Edmund stepped out first. He was 34 years old, broad-shouldered, and had the particular stillness of a man who had spent 3 years in the army learning that most problems could be solved by simply waiting for them to become someone else's problem. He was not unhandsome. He was not unkind. He was, however, deeply, profoundly tired of London, of society, of his mother's persistent suggestions regarding eligible young women and of people in general. He had bought this estate for one reason only. Silence. The housekeeper, a stout woman named Mrs. Briggs, who had survived the previous Duke's chaos with the grim endurance of someone who had seen everything and been surprised by none of it, met him at the door. Behind her stood a small line of staff. A footman. Two maids. A very old groundskeeper who appeared to be asleep standing up. And at the very end of the line, half hidden behind the older maid's considerable shadow, stood a young woman. She was not in uniform. That was the first thing Edmund noticed. Every other member of staff wore the dark, practical clothing of household service. This woman wore a gray dress, simple, well-worn, but cut in a way that did not quite belong to the servants' hall. Her dark hair was pulled back severely, as though she were trying to make herself look plainer than she was. Her hands were clasped in front of her. Her eyes were fixed on the gravel at her feet. Edmund filed the observation away and said nothing. The tour of the house took 2 hours. It was, to put it charitably, a project. The East Wing leaked. The library had not been dusted since approximately the reign of George II. The kitchens were functional but grim, and the wine cellar, once reportedly magnificent, had been comprehensively emptied by its previous occupant in what appeared to have been a dedicated final effort. It was in the kitchen that Edmund encountered the woman again. She was standing at the large wooden table, sleeves rolled to the elbow, hands red from cold water, sorting through what appeared to be a considerable pile of silver that had not been polished in a very long time. She did not look up when he entered. "You," Edmund said. She looked up then. Her eyes were an unusual shade, gray, or perhaps green, or perhaps the particular color that exists between the two when the light cannot quite make up its mind. "Your Grace," she said. Her voice was quiet. Controlled. What is your role here? A pause. So brief that he almost missed it. I help where I am needed, Your Grace. It was not, he would reflect later, an answer to the question he had asked. But something in her manner discouraged him from pressing further, which irritated him, because Edmund Ashford was not a man who was easily discouraged from anything. I need the east wing surveyed for water damage, he said instead. The library cataloged. And this silver finished by Friday. Yes, Your Grace. She returned to the silver. He returned to his tour. It was his solicitor, Parton, who gave him the closest thing to an explanation. She has nowhere to go, Parton said that evening, over a dinner that the kitchen had produced with surprising competence. The late Duke left no instructions regarding her future. No funds set aside. No family to speak of, he paused. She is, for lack of a better term, a leftover. Edmund looked up from his plate. A leftover of the previous household, Your Grace. She has been here since childhood. She is, Parton set down his fork and chose his words with visible care. She is not precisely a servant, but she is also not precisely anything else. That is extraordinarily unhelpful, Parton. Yes, Your Grace. I am aware. Edmund said nothing more on the subject. But he noticed things in the days that followed, in the way that men who have survived war learn to notice things quietly, without appearing to look. He noticed that Mrs. Briggs deferred to her in small ways. The tilt of a head. A glance before a decision. Nothing obvious. Nothing that could be named. He noticed that she ate after the other servants, alone, at the end of the kitchen table, with a book propped against the salt cellar. Not a recipe book. Not a household manual. A novel. In French. He noticed that she never spoke unless spoken to, and yet the house seemed to organize itself around her in some invisible way. The way a river organizes itself around a stone, not because the stone commands it, but because the stone has simply always been there. He found her useful. He found her efficient. He found her, on three separate occasions, faintly maddening in ways he could not adequately explain. It was on the ninth night that he found her in the library. He had come down past midnight, unable to sleep, intending to find something dull enough to bore him into unconsciousness. The library door was ajar. A single lamp burned inside. She was sitting at the late Duke's desk. Not cleaning it. Not dusting the shelves. Sitting at it in the Duke's own chair, with a stack of letters open before her, reading by lamplight with an expression on her face that Edmund could not immediately name. It was not guilt. It was something older than guilt. He pushed open the door. She rose so quickly that the chair scraped back, and for one unguarded moment her face showed something raw and startled before the composure returned, like a curtain pulled across a window. Your Grace, I apologize. I will. Servants, Edmund said, and his voice came out harder than he intended, are not permitted in this room. The silence stretched between them. And then she did something he did not expect. She looked at him directly, steadily, with those gray-green eyes that belonged to no servant he had ever employed, and she said, very quietly, I know. She set the letters down carefully. She walked to the door. She passed within 2 feet of him without dropping her gaze. And then she was gone, and he was standing alone in the library with a lamp burning on the desk and a stack of old letters and the absolute certainty that he had just asked entirely the wrong question. He stood there for a long time. Then he walked to the desk and looked at the letters. They were addressed, every single one of them in a child's careful handwriting. To Papa. Edmund did not sleep that night. He told himself it was the house. Old houses made old sounds, the settling of beams, the complaint of pipes, the particular groan of a building that had been holding itself together through stubbornness alone for longer than anyone could reasonably expect. Merindale Manor had plenty of those sounds. He lay in the late Duke's bed, his bed now, technically, though it still felt like borrowing, and listened to the darkness and thought about nothing in particular. He was lying, of course. He was thinking about the letters. A child's handwriting. Careful, deliberate, the letters slightly too large in the way of children who are trying very hard to be neat. And the late Duke had kept them, not in a box, not filed away with household accounts, but on his desk. Where he worked. Where he sat every day. Edmund rose before dawn, dressed without calling for his valet, and went back to the library. The letters were exactly where she had left them. He did not read them. He was not certain why. He sat in the Duke's chair, his chair, and looked at them for a long time. Then he got up and walked to the far end of the library, to the wall that connected to the main hallway, and stood in front of the thing he had somehow failed to properly look at in 9 days of living in this house. The portrait. It was large. They always were, in houses like this, as though the aristocracy believed that scale was a form of permanence. The late Duke was painted in his prime, 40 perhaps, standing beside a window with the estate visible behind him. A handsome man. Dark-haired. Satisfied with himself, in the way of men who have never had reason to doubt their place in the world. Beside him seated was a woman. Fair, elegant, with the careful expression of someone who has been told to sit still for a very long time. And in front of them both, standing slightly apart from her mother in the unconscious way of children who have not yet learned to perform for painters, was a little girl. Dark-haired, serious-faced, gray-green eyes. Edmund stood very still. The little girl in the portrait was perhaps 7 or 8 years old. Her dress was blue. Her hands were clasped in front of her, in exactly the way that a woman downstairs clasped her hands when she was trying not to show what she was feeling. He looked at the portrait for a long time. Then he went to find Parton. He found his solicitor at breakfast, working through a plate of eggs with the focused devotion of a man who considered food one of the few reliable pleasures left in a complicated world. The portrait in the library, Edmund said without preamble. Parton looked up. Something moved across his face quickly, carefully contained. Your Grace. The child. Who is she? A pause. Parton set down his fork with the particular deliberateness of a man buying himself time. The late Duke had a daughter, Parton said finally. She died young, I believe. Fever. Very sad, he picked his fork back up. Terrible thing. Edmund looked at him. Parton was a competent solicitor. He was organized, thorough, and had handled Edmund's legal affairs for 6 years without significant error. He was also, Edmund now observed, a genuinely terrible liar. Is that so? Edmund said. Yes, Your Grace. How young? Another pause. Fractionally too long. I confess, I don't recall the precise details. Edmund poured himself coffee. And the woman currently residing in my east wing. The dependent. Does she have a name? Clara, Parton said. Clara. Ashby. Ashby, Edmund repeated it slowly. Not Ashford. No, Your Grace. The late Duke's name was Ashford. Yes, Your Grace. And his daughter's name would have been. "Your grace," Parton set down his fork again. His voice had acquired a careful, diplomatic quality that Edmund recognized as the sound of a man who has been paid to keep a secret and is now deeply regretting the arrangement. "There are certain matters pertaining to the late Duke's private affairs that were handled with a degree of discretion that I am not entirely at liberty to." Parton. "Yes, Your Grace. You are my solicitor." A long pause. "Yes, Your Grace." "Then your discretion," Edmund said pleasantly, "belongs to me." Parton looked at his eggs. He looked at the door. He looked at the middle distance with the expression of a man reviewing his life choices. "I think," he said at last, very quietly, "that this particular matter may require some additional investigation before I can speak to it with any confidence." Edmund looked at him for a moment longer. Then he stood, straightened his coat, and left the breakfast room. He had his answer. It simply wasn't the one Parton had given him. He watched her more carefully after that. Not obviously. Edmund had learned patience in places where impatience got men killed, and he applied the same discipline here. He observed. He catalogued. He assembled. He noticed that she spoke to the kitchen maid in Italian when she thought no one could hear, not fluently, but comfortably, the way one speaks a language learned young. He noticed that when his mother's letter arrived, thick, cream-colored, sealed with enough wax to build a small candle, Clara was the one who brought it to him, and she held it with two hands, carefully, in the manner of someone who has been taught that correspondence is not to be handled carelessly. He noticed that she moved through the house with a specific familiarity that was different from the familiarity of a servant. A servant knows which doors stick and which floorboards creak, because they have learned these things through daily work. Clara moved through Merrindale as though she had known it before she had known anything else. As though the house were not a place she had come to, but a place she had come from. He noticed, one afternoon, that she stood for a long time in the doorway of what had been, according to Mrs. Briggs, the late Duke's private sitting room, which had been closed since his death and smelled of old pipe smoke, and something that might once have been happiness. She stood there with one hand on the door frame and did not go in. And he noticed, most damningly, that when Lord Harwick's name came up at dinner, Harwick, the late Duke's nearest surviving male relation, who had written twice already to inquire about the state of the estate and the terms of the sale, Clara's hands went very still on the water jug she was holding. Just for a moment. Just a fraction of a second. But Edmund noticed. His mother arrived on a Thursday. Lady Ashford, the Dowager Duchess, as she preferred, with heavy emphasis on the Dowager, descended from her carriage with the air of a woman arriving to inspect damages after a flood. She was 61, impeccably dressed, and had opinions about everything, which she offered freely and without any particular concern for whether they had been requested. She toured the house with Edmund, commenting on the state of the wallpaper, the inadequacy of the entrance hall, and the general failure of the previous Duke to maintain standards that she considered the bare minimum of civilized existence. She was in the middle of a comprehensive assessment of the drawing-room curtains when Clara came in to set the afternoon tea. Lady Ashford stopped talking mid-sentence. Clara set the tray down. Arranged the cups. Did not look up. "Edmund," his mother said, in a tone he recognized, the particular tone of someone who has seen something they cannot immediately classify. "Mother, who is that girl?" "Staff," he said. "She came with the property." His mother was quiet for a moment. Clara finished with the tray and moved to leave, and as she turned toward the door, Lady Ashford's gaze sharpened with the focus of a woman who had spent 40 years in society cataloging faces and bloodlines and the invisible grammar of breeding. "Wait," his mother said. Clara stopped, turned. Lady Ashford looked at her, really looked the way she looked at portraits, at silverware, at anything she was trying to authenticate. "What is your name?" "Clara, my lady." "Clara what?" The briefest pause. "Ashby, my lady." "Ashby." Lady Ashford repeated it with the polite skepticism of someone who does not believe a word of it. "Where are you from, Clara Ashby?" "Here, my lady." "I have always been here." Another silence. Something moved across Lady Ashford's face, not recognition exactly, but the shadow of it. The almost. "You may go," she said at last. Clara went. Lady Ashford turned to Edmund and looked at him with an expression he could not entirely read. "Edmund," she said quietly, "that girl did not come with the furniture." "No," he agreed. "I don't believe she did." That night he asked her directly. He waited until the house was quiet, until the last lamp had been turned down in the servants' hall, and then he went to the kitchen where he knew, somehow, without knowing quite how he knew, that she would still be there. She was at the table. No book this time. Just her hands flat on the wood, and the dying fire, and the expression of someone who has been waiting for something for a very long time, and is not entirely sure they want it to arrive. He put the portrait sketch on the table in front of her. He had drawn it himself, rough, quick, but accurate. The little girl. The blue dress. The clasped hands. She looked at it for a long time. "Clara," he said. "Your Grace, I am going to ask you one question. I would like one honest answer." She looked up at him. In the firelight, her eyes were more gray than green, and there was something in them that was not quite fear and not quite hope, but lived somewhere in the exhausted country between them. "How long," he asked very quietly, "have you lived in this house?" The silence stretched between them like the distance across a very wide river. "Since I was 3 years old," she said at last. She stood up from the table. She walked to the door. And then she stopped with her back to him and said so quietly that he almost missed it. "He was going to tell you. He wrote the letter. He died before he could send it." She left. Edmund sat down slowly in the chair she had vacated. He sat there for a long time. Then he went upstairs, unlocked the late Duke's private correspondence box that Parton had given him on the first day, just household matters, Your Grace, nothing of significance, and began, methodically, to read. He found the letter on the third hour. Near the bottom of the box, in an envelope that had been sealed and addressed and never sent. The address on the front read, E. Ashford, Duke of Merindale. His own name. His hands were not entirely steady as he broke the seal. The letter was 3 pages long. He read it once quickly, then again slowly. Then he set it down on the desk and pressed his fingers against his eyes, and sat very still in the quiet of a house that was beginning slowly to tell him all the things it had been keeping. "She is my daughter," the letter began. "I need you to understand that before anything else. Whatever else you learn, whatever else is said, she is my daughter, and I failed her, and I am asking you, a stranger, a man I have never met, to do what I could not. Her name is not Ashby. I gave her that name to protect her. Her name is Clara Ashford, and she is the rightful heir to half of everything you now own." Down the hall in the east wing, a young woman lay awake in the dark. She had been waiting 22 years for someone to find that letter. She had begun, somewhere around year 18, to stop believing anyone would. He did not sleep at all. By the time the first gray light of morning crept through the library windows, Edmund had read the late Duke's letter 4 times, and each time he finished it, he sat for a moment in the silence and then turned back to the beginning and read it again, as though repetition might somehow change what it said. It did not change. Her mother was not my wife, the Duke had written in the careful, slightly formal prose of a man dictating his confession to paper. I want to be honest about that, because Clara deserves honesty even if she has received very little of it in her life. Her mother was a woman of good family but no title, a rector's daughter, intelligent and kind, and I loved her in the way that men of my position are not supposed to love women of hers. We could not marry. My family would not permit it. I was weak. I permitted them. Her mother died when Clara was 3. I brought the child here because I could not do otherwise. I could not leave my own daughter with strangers. I told no one the truth of her parentage. I called her a ward, a dependent. I gave her a false name. I told myself it was to protect her. I know now that I was also protecting myself. I had a will prepared, a proper one, with Clara named and her inheritance documented. But Harwick found out. I don't know how. He threatened to contest it, to expose Clara's birth, to have her declared illegitimate in the most public and damaging way possible if I proceeded. He wanted the estate. He has always wanted the estate. And I was dying. I was frightened. And I made the worst decision of my life. I destroyed the will. I sold the estate to settle the debts, because at least that way Harwick could not have it. I told myself Clara would be safe, that whoever purchased the property would be decent, would provide for her, would not turn her out. I told myself this because I needed to believe it. The second will, the real one, is in the hands of my oldest servant, Thomas Hartley. He has been with me 30 years. He knows everything. He has a copy, held in trust, to be produced when the time is right. I am asking you to find Thomas. I am asking you to help my daughter. I know I have no right to ask anything of you. I know this is not your burden. But she has no one else. The letter ended there. No signature. The Duke had died, Edmund supposed, before he could finish it. He folded it carefully and put it in his coat pocket. Then he went to find Clara. She was in the garden. Not working, simply standing at the far edge of the formal lawn, where the grounds gave way to a line of old oaks that must have been there for 100 years or more. Her arms were wrapped around herself against the morning cold. She had not heard him coming, and for a moment he saw her as she was when she believed herself unobserved, the composure gone, the careful blankness dropped, just a young woman standing very still in the cold morning looking at trees that had been there for her entire life. He stopped a few feet away. She turned, heard him, and the composure came back instantly, the lifted chin, the clasped hands, the polite distance. Your Grace. I apologize, I was just. I found the letter, he said. The composure did not break. But something behind it did, a small, almost invisible fracture, like a crack appearing in glass a moment before it shatters. Which letter? She said carefully. He took it from his pocket. She looked at it for a long time. She looked at her father's handwriting on the outside, his particular, formal script that she would have known anywhere, had known since she was 4 years old learning her alphabet from the books in his library. And then, for the first time since Edmund had arrived at Merindale, Clara Ashford, who had survived 22 years of silence and invisibility, and the specific, grinding humiliation of being erased from her own life, sat down on the cold stone garden bench, put her face in her hands, and wept. Edmund stood there. He was not a man accustomed to tears. The army had not been particularly conducive to them, and his mother expressed emotion primarily through the precise arrangement of furniture. He was not certain what to do. He sat down on the bench beside her and said nothing. He did not tell her it would be all right. He did not tell her to compose herself. He simply sat there, close enough that she was not alone, and waited. It lasted perhaps 5 minutes. Then she pressed both hands flat against her face, took a slow breath, and lifted her head. Her eyes were red. Her composure was imperfect. She looked more real than he had ever seen her. "He tried," she said. Her voice was rough. "I always believed he tried." "He did," Edmund said. "Badly and too late, and in ways that caused you considerable harm. But he tried." She looked at him with a flicker of something, surprise perhaps at the honesty. "Tell me," he said. "All of it. I need to understand." She told him. It took a long time, and she told it in the flat, careful way of someone who has rehearsed a story so many times in their own head that the telling of it has become a kind of armor facts presented without drama, because the drama is too large to be safely released. Her mother had died of fever when Clara was 3. Her father had brought her to Merrindale and told the staff she was the daughter of a deceased distant relation. He had educated her privately, languages, music, history, everything a duke's daughter should know, while simultaneously teaching her that she must never, under any circumstances, claim to be what she was. "He said it was temporary," she told Edmund, her hands wrapped around the cup of tea that Mrs. Briggs had appeared with at some point, with the unerring instinct of a housekeeper who understood that certain conversations required something warm to hold. "Every year he said it was temporary. Every year something prevented him from formalizing it. Harwick or the lawyers or his own fear, I am not certain which in the end was the largest obstacle." She had grown up in the house like a ghost. Present in every room, visible to everyone, acknowledged by no one. The servants knew or suspected, but no one spoke of it. Mrs. Briggs had been kind, in her gruff, practical way. Thomas Hartley had been her one true confidant, the only person in the house who had ever called her by her real name. "Where is Thomas now?" Edmund asked. Something flickered across her face. "He left 6 months before my father died. Harwick, I don't know what Harwick said to him, or threatened him with. Thomas would not tell me. He simply came to me one night and pressed a piece of paper into my hand and said, 'Keep this safe,' and then he was gone." "What was on the paper?" She was quiet for a moment. Then she stood up and went inside and came back 10 minutes later with a small envelope that she had kept. Edmund could tell from its worn edges and soft creases, folded and close to her person for a very long time. He opened it. It was an address. A village in Shropshire, a name and 3 words in Thomas Hartley's elderly, reliable handwriting, "When you are ready." Edmund looked at it for a long moment. "You have had this for 6 months," he said. "You could have gone to him. You could have used whatever document he holds to establish your identity." "And then what?" she said quietly. "Present myself, alone, as the illegitimate daughter of a dead duke. Against Harwick, who has money and lawyers and 30 years of practice in making things go his way." "I needed," she stopped. "You needed someone," Edmund said. She said nothing. Which was, he had learned, her way of saying yes. He sent a rider to Shropshire that afternoon. He did not tell Parton. He was not yet certain how much Parton knew, or how much of Parton's allegiance had been quietly purchased over the years by a duke who could no longer pay his own bills. He filed the question away for later and focused on what he could control. What he could control at the moment was considerably less than he would have liked. He had a letter that established Clara's parentage in her father's own hand, but which was unsigned and therefore legally questionable. He had an address in Shropshire, and the hope that a 70-year-old former servant was still alive and still in possession of whatever document the late Duke had entrusted to him. He had a young woman whose entire existence had been systematically falsified by people who were supposed to protect her. And he had Lord Harwick. Harwick's third letter arrived that same afternoon, and it was considerably less polite than the previous two. Edmund read it at his desk with the focused attention of a man, assembling the dimensions of a problem. Harwick had heard, the letter stated, that there was a dependent residing at Merrindale Manor. He wished to make it clear that any such dependent was, legally speaking, the responsibility of the estate and not of any individual associated with it. He further wished to make it clear that he had retained counsel to examine the terms of the late Duke's final arrangements, and that he had reason to believe certain matters had not been handled with full transparency. He would be calling, the letter concluded, on Friday. Edmund set the letter down. He had 4 days. He told Clara that evening. She received the news with the stillness of someone who has been bracing for a particular blow for long enough that, when it finally comes, it almost feels like relief. "He knows," she said. "He has always known or suspected. That is why he wanted the estate, not for the land or the house, but to control whatever documents my father might have left behind." "Then we need to find Thomas before Friday," Edmund said. "We," she repeated. "Very carefully." He looked at her. "Yes. We." She was quiet for a moment. "Then why?" It was a genuine question. He could see that no artifice, no performance, just a young woman who had learned through long experience not to trust offers of assistance and wanted to understand precisely what this one was going to cost her. He considered the question seriously because it deserved seriousness. "Because your father asked me to," he said. "And because what was done to you was wrong. And because," he stopped, looked at the fire, "because I have been in this house for 2 weeks, and in that time I have watched you manage every crisis, translate 2 languages, prevent misses." Briggs, from dismissing the kitchen maid over a broken soup tureen, and single-handedly catalog 400 years of family correspondence. "And it seems to me that a woman with those particular qualities ought to at least be permitted to use her real name." A long silence. "That is a very practical reason," she said at last. "I am a very practical man." Something moved at the corner of her mouth. Not quite a smile. The memory of one, perhaps, returning from wherever she had put it for safekeeping. "My real name," she said quietly, "is Clara Ashford." "I know," he said. "How do you do?" The writer returned from Shropshire on Thursday morning. Thomas Hartley was alive. He was 73 years old, entirely healthy, and had been, according to the writer's account, sitting in a cottage in Shropshire for 6 months with a locked document case on his kitchen table, waiting. He would come, the writer reported immediately. Edmund passed the message to Clara over breakfast, formally, in the dining room, because he had quietly stopped pretending that she ate in the kitchen 2 days ago, and Mrs. Briggs had quietly stopped pretending to be surprised. She read the note, pressed her lips together, nodded once. Then she looked up, and there was something in her eyes that he had not seen there before, not hope exactly, which was too fragile a word for it. Something more durable than hope. Readiness. Lord Harwick arrived on Friday at 11 o'clock. He was a large man, florid-faced, with the expansive physical confidence of someone who has never had a room tell him to leave. He arrived with two lawyers, a personal secretary, and the air of a man who has already decided how the meeting will end. Edmund received him in the formal drawing room. Alone, Harwick looked around the room with the proprietary assessment of a man pricing furniture. "Ashford," he said, "good of you to receive me. I trust you've had time to review my correspondence." "I have," Edmund said pleasantly. "Sit down." Harwick sat. His lawyers arranged themselves behind him like expensive scenery. "I'll be direct," Harwick said. "There is a woman in this house. A dependent. I have reason to believe that this woman is connected to certain documents that properly belong in my possession, as the late Duke's nearest legitimate relation." "What sort of documents?" Edmund said. "Documents pertaining to the estate. To certain private arrangements the late Duke may have made." Harwick's smile did not reach his eyes. "I am sure you understand." "I understand perfectly," Edmund said. He stood up, crossed to the door, and opened it. Clara walked in. Harwick went very still. She was not wearing gray. Edmund had said nothing to her about what she chose to wear today. It was not his place to say anything. But she had appeared at the top of the stairs that morning in a deep blue dress that he had never seen before, her hair arranged with simple precision, her back straight, her hands not clasped but simply at her sides, open and steady. She looked, he thought, exactly like the little girl in the portrait, and nothing at all like a servant. "Lord Harwick," she said. Her voice was perfectly level. "I believe you know who I am." Harwick's florid complexion had taken on a slightly gray quality. "I know who you claim to be," he said. "Claims are not documentation." "No," Clara agreed. "They are not." And then the door opened again, and Thomas Hartley walked in. He was a small, slight man of 73, white-haired, with the careful, deliberate movements of someone who has carried something important for a very long time and has not dropped it yet. He carried a document case under his arm. He looked at Clara and something moved across his face, profound, complicated, the look of a man who has kept a promise for a very long time and has finally been allowed to complete it. "Miss Ashford," he said. Her breath caught. Just slightly. The only crack in the composure. "Thomas," she said. "Thank you for waiting." He set the document case on the table. He unlocked it with a small key from his waistcoat pocket. He removed a sealed envelope and placed it in Clara's hands. Then he looked at Harwick with the calm, clear gaze of a man who has absolutely nothing left to fear. "The late Duke entrusted me with this," he said, "in the presence of a solicitor, a witness, and a notary 6 years ago. It is a signed and properly executed will, legal in every particular. I have also," he added, reaching back into the case, "a letter, a birth record, and a baptismal certificate." He laid each document on the table as he named it. "All properly authenticated," he said. "All pertaining to one Clara Margaret Ashford, daughter of the 5th Duke of Merindale." The room was very quiet. Harwick looked at the documents. He looked at Clara. He looked at Edmund, who was standing by the fireplace with his arms folded and an expression of mild, attentive patience. "This will not hold," Harwick said. His voice had acquired a slightly strangled quality. "She is illegitimate." "The court's will." "The will does not require legitimacy," Thomas said. "The late Duke had the right to bequeath, as he chose within his unentailed property. Counsel will confirm it. Harwick looked at his lawyers. His lawyers looked at the documents. His lawyers had the expressions of men who would be having a very difficult conversation with their client in the carriage on the way home. Harwick left at 12:30. He said very little on his way out. The lawyer said even less. The personal secretary gathered papers with the focused efficiency of a man pretending. He had not witnessed any of the last hour. Edmund stood at the window and watched the carriage roll down the drive until it disappeared behind the oaks. Behind him, Clara was sitting in the chair by the fireplace, not perching, not hovering at the edge of it the way she always had before, as though afraid to take up too much space, but sitting in it fully, her hands in her lap, the sealed envelope open beside her. She had not read it yet. She was looking at the fire. "It's over," Edmund said. "The first part," she said. "Yes." He turned from the window. She was looking at him now, and there was a question in her eyes that she was not yet asking. He crossed the room, sat down across from her in the other chair, in the ordinary domestic configuration of two people who have just survived something together and have not yet worked out what comes next. "The will," he said. "You haven't opened it. I know what it says. Tell me." She was quiet for a moment. The fire crackled. Thomas Hartley had been settled in the kitchen by Mrs. Briggs with the decisive hospitality of a woman who considers proper tea the appropriate response to most crises. "Half," Clara said. "If my identity is ever legally established, half of the unentailed property of the estate reverts to me." She paused. "Half of Merindale." Edmund absorbed this. Half of the estate he had purchased. Half of the land, the house, the lakes, the silence he had come here to find. And across from him sat a young woman who had been waiting 22 years for this moment, who had a better claim to this house than he did, who had more right to that chair by that fire than anyone else in England. "I see," he said. "You could contest it," she said. "Many men would." "Yes," he agreed. "Many men would." "Are you going to?" she asked. "Very carefully. In the manner of someone who has learned not to assume the answer." Edmund looked at the fire. He looked at the window where the oaks were standing in their patient, 100-year way. He looked at the woman across from him who had been in this house since she was 3 years old and had never once been permitted to simply be here. "No," he said. "I am not." She looked at him for a long moment, searching in the way she had, thorough, undefended, the look of someone who cannot afford to be deceived. Whatever she found, it seemed to satisfy her. "Thank you," she said. "Don't thank me," he said. "It's your house." "Half," she said. "Half," he agreed. And there, in the pause that followed, in the warmth of the fire and the quiet of the house that was, finally, technically, legally, also hers, something shifted between them. Too subtle to be named yet. Too certain to be ignored. Edmund looked away first. He was not, he told himself, a man who was unsettled by things. He was also, he was beginning to discover, not a very reliable narrator of his own experience. That night, for the first time in 22 years, Clara Ashford slept in her father's house as herself. Not as a servant. Not as a dependent. Not as a leftover. As his daughter. The east wing still leaked. The wine cellar was still empty. The bad-tempered bull named Wellington still had opinions about everything. But the house felt somehow different. As though it had been holding its breath for a very long time. And had finally, quietly, let it go. The morning after Harwick left, Edmund came down to breakfast and found Clara already at the table. Not at the end of it, where she had always positioned herself before, half in, half out, occupying the minimum possible space as though apologizing for her own presence. She was sitting at the side, midway down, with a cup of tea and a letter she was writing, and she looked up when he entered with the particular expression of someone who has decided, overnight, to stop making themselves small. He sat down across from her. Messes. Briggs appeared with coffee and the careful non-expression of a woman who had waited 22 years for this particular breakfast and was not going to ruin it by acknowledging it. They ate in silence for a while. A companionable silence, the kind that does not require filling. "I need to go into the village today," Clara said, without looking up from her letter. "There are practical matters. The solicitor's office. The parish records." "I'll come with you," Edmund said. She looked up then. "You don't need to," she said. "I know," he said. "I'll come with you." A pause. She looked at him with that thorough, searching look. Then she returned to her letter. "Very well," she said. It was not, Edmund reflected, the most enthusiastic acceptance he had ever received. But it was, he was learning, entirely characteristic of Clara Ashford, who expressed agreement the way other people express devotion, briefly, precisely, and only when she meant it. The village of Merindale was small, self-contained, and had been observing the comings and goings of the manor house for 300 years, with the dedicated interest of a community that considers the aristocracy its primary form of entertainment. Edmund was aware, as they walked from the carriage to the solicitor's office, that they were being watched. Windows. Doorways. The particular quality of stillness that descends on a street when something interesting is happening, and everyone wants to see without appearing to look. Clara was aware of it too. He could tell by the set of her shoulders, not tense exactly, but prepared. The posture of someone who has been observed and judged their entire life, and has learned to move through it. At the solicitor's office, a mister. Fellows who had served Merindale for 40 years and had the complexion of a man who had spent those years entirely indoors. Clara presented Thomas Hartley's documents with the quiet efficiency of someone completing a long overdue task. Fellows reviewed them. He reviewed them again. He removed his spectacles, cleaned them, replaced them, and reviewed them a third time. Then he looked up at Clara over the rims of his spectacles with the expression of a man who is recalculating a great many things simultaneously. "Miss Ashford," he said, and then stopped as though testing the words. "Yes," Clara said. "I knew your father for 30 years, Fellows said slowly. "I always thought," he stopped again. "I am very glad," he said finally, "that this has been resolved." It was not much, but Clara received it with a stillness that Edmund recognized, by now, as the way she accepted things that mattered more than she would let anyone see. It was on the walk back to the carriage that the trouble began. There were three of them, minor gentry, the kind whose families had occupied the second tier of county society for generations, and maintained their position primarily through the careful management of other people's reputations. Edmund did not know their names. He would learn them later and forget them immediately, because they were not the kind of men who deserved the effort of remembering. They were standing outside the inn, and they had clearly been there long enough to have formed opinions. "Ashford," said the tallest one, with a nod that was precisely calibrated to be respectful enough to be irreproachable and dismissive enough to make its point. His gaze moved to Clara. "And this must be the dependent." The way he said the word was a small, precise act of violence. Edmund felt something go very still in him. The particular stillness he had learned in the army, the stillness that precedes action rather than following it. "This," he said, in the pleasantly level tone that his regiment had learned to recognize as genuinely dangerous, "is Miss Clara Ashford, daughter of the 5th Duke of Merindale. I suggest you adjust your address accordingly." The tallest man's smile did not waver, but something behind it did. "Ashford." "Yes." "We had heard some story." "It is not a story," Edmund said. "It is a legal fact, documented and witnessed. Miss Ashford's identity has been established beyond any question that I would recommend you raise." He said it pleasantly. He said it in the tone of a man, offering information rather than a threat. The three men looked at each other. They looked at Edmund, who was 6 feet tall, had spent 3 years in active military service, and was currently looking at them with the patient, absolute calm of someone who has absolutely nothing to prove, and is therefore significantly more frightening than someone who does. They looked at Clara, who was looking at them with an expression of such composed, complete indifference that it was somehow worse than anger. "Miss Ashford," said the tallest man, after a pause that had gone on precisely long enough to be uncomfortable. He nodded. "Stiffly. Correctly." "Gentlemen," Clara said. They left. Edmund and Clara walked to the carriage in silence. He handed her in. He got in after her. The carriage moved off. They rode for perhaps 2 minutes before Clara said, without inflection, "You didn't have to do that." "Yes, I did," Edmund said. "Thank you," she said. "You're welcome." Another pause. Longer. "You're angry," she said. He considered this. "Not at you." "I know," she said. "I meant in general." He looked out the window at the passing countryside, the fields, the hedgerows, the sky that had gone the color of pewter. "I have been," he said carefully, "in this county for 3 weeks. In that time, I have learned that a woman was systematically erased from her own life by people who were supposed to care for her, and that the community in which she lived apparently preferred not to notice." He paused. "Yes. I am somewhat angry in general." Clara was quiet for a moment. "I used to be," she said, "angry. When I was younger, I would lie awake," and she stopped. "Started again. I stopped eventually. It took too much. And it changed nothing." "What replaced it?" he asked. She looked at him steadily. "Patience," she said, "and the decision to outlast them." Edmund looked at her, at the composed, precise, quietly formidable woman sitting across from him, who had been waiting for 22 years with the focused endurance of someone who knew, with absolute certainty, that they were right. "You succeeded," he said. "Not entirely," she said. "Not yet." Harwick's response came on Monday. Edmund had expected it. The only question had been the form. Harwick was not a man who retreated gracefully. He was a man who, when one road was closed, immediately began looking for another, and he had been looking, apparently, with considerable energy over the preceding 3 days. The letter was from Harwick's lawyers rather than Harwick himself, which was the first sign that they had found something. Edmund read it standing at his desk, because he had a feeling it was not the kind of letter one wanted to receive sitting down. He had been correct. The letter was long, precisely worded, and built its case with the careful architecture of people who are paid to be difficult. Its essential argument was this: while they did not dispute the documentation establishing Clara's parentage, they did dispute the validity of the will on a technicality of execution. A witness signature that had been applied, they claimed, under circumstances that rendered it legally questionable. The matter, they proposed, should be referred to the Court of Chancery. The Court of Chancery, Edmund knew from painful personal experience, moved with the urgency of a glacier and the expense of a small war. A case referred there could take years. In those years, Clara's legal status would remain unresolved. Her claim to the estate would be frozen, and she would remain, in the eyes of society, precisely what she had always been. Nothing. He put the letter down. He sat at his desk for a long time. He thought about the portrait in the library, and the little girl in the blue dress who had become a woman who ate alone at the end of the kitchen table with a French novel and never complained. He thought about the letters in a child's careful handwriting, addressed to Papa that a dying man had kept on his desk, because he could not let them go. He thought about Harwick in the drawing room, looking at Clara with the casual ownership of a man who has always believed that some people exist primarily for his convenience. He thought about what Clara had said in the carriage, the decision to outlast them. And then, with the particular clarity that sometimes arrives after a long stillness, he knew what he was going to do. It was, objectively, an extraordinary decision. His mother would be appalled. Society would talk. The lawyers would have opinions. Harwick would be, and this, Edmund acknowledged privately, was not entirely without appeal, absolutely furious. He called for his writing things. He wrote two letters. The first was to his mother. The second was to the editor of the most widely read society paper in London, to which Lady Ashford subscribed, and which was, in Edmund's estimation, read by approximately everyone who mattered and a significant number of people who didn't. He sealed both letters and gave them to the footman for the Morning Post. Then he went to find Clara. She was in the library. Not at the desk this time, she was standing in front of the portrait, looking at it with the quiet, complicated expression of someone reconciling the person they were with the person they had become. He stood beside her and looked at the portrait with her for a moment. The little girl in the blue dress looked back at them both. "I need to ask you something," Edmund said. "All right," she said. "It is an unconventional question." "I have had an unconventional life," she said. "I can manage it." He turned to face her. She turned to face him. In the afternoon light of the library, with the portrait of her family behind her and the house around them and 22 years of waiting finally, imperfectly, arriving at something like resolution, she looked, he thought, like herself. Precisely and completely herself. "Harwick is going to take this to Chancery," he said. "If he does, it will take years. Your claim will be frozen. Your position here will remain ambiguous." He paused. "I cannot prevent him from filing." "I know," she said. "But I can make it considerably more difficult for him to win." She was watching him carefully. "How?" "The law," Edmund said, "as currently constructed, gives a husband considerable authority over property disputes pertaining to his wife. If you were married to someone with resources and legal counsel and a profound personal interest in seeing Harwick lose, the case becomes materially different." The silence was very complete. Clara looked at him. He could not entirely read her expression. She was, as always, thorough about what she let him see. "That," she said at last, "is either the most practical proposal in the history of Merindale or the strangest one." "Possibly both," he said. "You are proposing marriage," she said. "To protect my legal interests." "I am proposing marriage," he said carefully, "because Harwick needs to be defeated, and because this house needs someone in it who actually belongs here, and because..." He stopped. "Because," she said, He looked at her, at the gray-green eyes that had been watching him, clearly and steadily, since the first morning he had walked into his own kitchen and found her there. "Because," he said, "I have been looking for a reason to stay in this house, and I find that you have become one." The silence stretched between them. Clara looked at him for a very long time. The thorough, searching look, the one that had, he suspected, never in her life been wrong about what it found. "This is not," she said slowly, "how I imagined this conversation would go."
"How did you imagine it?"
"I didn't," she said. "I stopped imagining things I didn't believe would happen." A pause. "I am not certain I know how to do this."
"Neither am I," he said.
"I thought we might work it out as we go." Something crossed her face, the ghost of the smile that had been returning, increment by increment, since the night he had sat beside her in the cold garden and simply waited.
"That," she said, "is a very practical approach."
"I'm a very practical man," he said.
"You may recall."
"I recall," she said.
The smile arrived then.
Small, precise, entirely genuine. The smile of a woman who has kept it somewhere safe for a very long time and has decided, finally, that it is worth the risk of taking it out.
"Yes," she said.
"Yes, you recall, or yes?"
"Yes," she said.
"Both." The society paper ran the announcement on Wednesday. Lady Ashford read it over breakfast in her London townhouse, made a sound that caused her butler to drop an entire tray of correspondence, and immediately called for her carriage. Harwick read it in his study, and the sound he made caused his personal secretary to excuse himself and not come back for the remainder of the day. The village of Merrindale read it, discussed it comprehensively at the inn and the market and the church steps, and arrived, with the decisive pragmatism of a community that understands which way the wind is blowing, at the collective conclusion that they had always known there was something significant about that girl at the manor. Thomas Hartley read it in his cottage in Shropshire, folded the paper carefully, and allowed himself, in the privacy of his kitchen, a smile of considerable satisfaction. Lady Ashford arrived on Thursday. She swept into the drawing room where Edmund and Clara were going over household accounts, together, at the same table, which would have been unthinkable 3 weeks ago, and stopped in the doorway and looked at them both with the comprehensive, assessing gaze of a woman who has decided to have opinions and is marshaling them in order.
"Edmund," she said.
"Mother, this is
Clara Ashford," Edmund said.
"Daughter of the fifth Duke.
My fiance.
You have met."
Lady Ashford looked at Clara. Clara looked at Lady Ashford. The silence had a particular quality, the quality of two people taking the measure of each other with complete honesty and no performance whatsoever.
"You play chess," Lady Ashford said abruptly.
Clara blinked.
"I do."
"Edmund cannot."
"I have been looking for a worthwhile opponent for 11 years. She set down her traveling bag.
"I will stay for a fortnight," she looked at her son.
"Close your mouth, Edmund." She sailed past them both toward the stairs.
Edmund and Clara looked at each other.
"Well," Clara said.
"Indeed," said Edmund.
Harwick's case collapsed 6 weeks later. His lawyers, upon examining the witness signature with the fresh scrutiny that comes from knowing you are about to face a duke with resources and motivation, discovered that their original assessment had been, in the careful language of legal correspondence, somewhat optimistic. The signature was valid. The will was sound. The documentation was, as Thomas Hartley had always known it to be, unimpeachable. Harwick did not concede gracefully. He was not the kind of man who did anything gracefully. But he conceded, which was the only thing that mattered.
the Court of Chancery never heard the case. Clara Margaret Ashford was formally, legally, irrevocably recognized as the daughter of the 5th Duke of Merindale, heir to half his unentailed estate, and as of a quiet ceremony in the Merindale Parish Church on a Friday morning in December, with Thomas Hartley and Mrs. Briggs as witnesses and Lady Ashford in the front pew looking ferociously pleased, the Duchess of Merindale. The bad-tempered bull named Wellington escaped his field the morning of the wedding and was discovered, 2 hours later, standing in the formal garden eating the last of the autumn roses. Edmund wanted to have him moved immediately. Clara said to leave him. "He has been here longer than either of us," she said. "He can have the roses." Edmund looked at her, this woman who had outlasted everything, who had waited and endured and kept her own name alive in her own heart when no one else would say it, who was standing in the garden of her father's house in a gray winter morning light as though she had always been exactly here and had simply been waiting for the world to catch up. "Yes," he said. "All right." He thought, not for the first time, that he had arrived at Merindale looking for silence. He had found something considerably better. Spring came to Merindale the way it always had. Slowly, then all at once, first a tentative green along the hedgerows, then the oaks coming into leaf, then one morning the whole estate simply decided it was done with winter and proceeded accordingly. The two lakes caught the light differently in April. The farmland, which Edmund had spent the winter quietly restoring with the focused attention of a man who has found something worth caring for, was showing the first real signs of becoming what it once had been. The east wing no longer leaked. This had required 3 months, 2 builders, and 1 extended argument between Edmund and a particularly opinionated craftsman from the village about the correct method for repairing a 100-year-old roof. Clara had settled the argument by producing a document from the estate archives, written in 1741, in the careful hand of the 2nd Duke, that described the original construction in comprehensive detail. The craftsman had accepted this with the grace of a man who has been defeated by primary sources. Edmund had looked at Clara across the table where she had found the document, his desk now, their desk, covered in estate correspondence and household accounts, and 3 of Lady Ashford's chess problems which she had left behind with the implicit expectation that someone would solve them, and said nothing. But the way he looked at her said a great deal. Clara had become accustomed, over the winter months, to the way Edmund said things without saying them. It was, she had concluded, one of his more useful qualities. He did not perform. He did not embellish. When he looked at her in a certain way, it meant precisely what it appeared to mean, without qualification or condition. She had spent 22 years in a house where nothing meant what it appeared to mean. She found the directness extravagantly, quietly restoring. Mrs. Briggs retired in March. She had been waiting. She informed Clara on a Tuesday morning with the air of someone completing a transaction they had been holding open for some time, until things were settled. Things were now settled. She would be going to live with her sister in Bath. "I always knew," she said, standing in the kitchen where Clara had eaten alone at the end of the table for 22 years. "I want you to know that. I always knew who you were." "I know," Clara said. "I should have done more." "You did what you could," Clara said. "In the circumstances you had," she paused. "You called me by my name, when no one else would. You did it quietly, when we were alone, but you did it." She looked at the older woman steadily. "That was not nothing, Mrs. Briggs." "Mrs." Briggs pressed her lips together in the manner of a woman who is not going to cry in the kitchen she has managed for 30 years. She was not entirely successful.
She left on a Thursday morning in a carriage that Edmund had arranged, with a pension that Clara had insisted upon, and Edmund had not argued with for a single moment, and a jar of the manor's preserved plums that she had made herself because she did not trust anyone else to do it correctly. Clara stood at the door and watched the carriage go. Then she went back inside and stood in the kitchen for a moment, this room that had been the boundary of her world for so long, and looked at it. Then she went upstairs to her father's library. Her library. She sat at the desk and opened the window and let the April air in and worked through the morning correspondence with the quiet, comprehensive competence of a woman who has been managing an estate in practice for 20 years and is now simply permitted to do it in theory as well. Thomas Hartley came for Easter. He was, by his own description, too old for long journeys and too stubborn to stop making them, and he arrived in the carriage Edmund sent for him with the document case still under his arm, empty now, but apparently a comfort nonetheless. He walked through the house slowly, room by room, with the expression of someone completing a long-deferred accounting. Clara walked with him. They did not say much. They had never needed to. Thomas had been the one person, in all the years of her strange half-existence, who had sat with her in the evenings and played cards and called her Miss Ashford when no one could hear and told her, in his plain, reliable way, that what was done to her was wrong and that it would not always be so. She had not always believed him. She believed him now. In the portrait gallery, for the main hall had a second, smaller gallery that Edmund had been sorting through since January, they stopped in front of a painting that had been brought down from storage. It was smaller than the formal family portrait in the library, and less formal, a study, perhaps, done by a private hand rather than a commissioned portraitist. It showed a young woman sitting in a garden chair, reading. Dark-haired, serious-faced. Perhaps 20 years old. She was not looking at the painter. She was entirely absorbed in her book, and there was something in her expression, unguarded, private, wholly itself, that could not have been posed. On the back in the late Duke's handwriting, see. In the South Garden. Summer. He had it painted, Thomas said quietly. Without telling you. He had someone come when you were reading outside. He said he stopped. He said he wanted to remember you, as you were when you didn't know you were being seen. He said that was when you were most yourself. Clara looked at the painting for a long time. Where was it? She asked. His private rooms, Thomas said. He looked at it every day. She stood very still. She had spent a great deal of the winter deciding what she thought of her father. He had loved her. She had never doubted that, even in the worst years. But love, she had concluded, is not the same as courage, and he had possessed the first in abundance and the second in insufficient quantities, and she had paid the price for the difference. She had decided, somewhere around February, that she could hold both of these things at once. That she could be grateful for the love and angry about the failure, and know that neither canceled the other. She could grieve him and be furious with him and miss him and forgive him, imperfectly, in increments. She was working on it. I would like it hung in the library, she said. Near the window. Yes, Miss Ashford, said Thomas. She looked at him. Clara, she said. You can say it aloud now. He smiled. A small, complete, deeply satisfied smile. Yes, Clara, he said. The formal acknowledgement came in April. It was not dramatic. It was a document, several documents, in fact, all properly executed and witnessed and filed in the appropriate offices. And it said, in the precise and bloodless language of the law, that Clara Margaret Ashford was the recognized natural daughter of the 5th Duke of Merindale, that her inheritance rights in the unentailed estate had been established, and that all previous informal arrangements pertaining to her residence and status were hereby superseded. It said, in other words, that she was real. Edmund brought the documents to the library and placed them on the desk in front of her without ceremony, because he had learned, over the winter, that Clara preferred things without ceremony. That ceremony was something that had always been performed around her and never for her, and she found the absence of it, in private moments, considerably more meaningful than its presence. She read through them. All of them. Carefully. Then she set them down and looked out the window at the south garden, where the first of the season's roses were beginning to consider the possibility of blooming. Well, she said. Well, Edmund agreed. That's done, then. That's done. Are you all right? He asked. She considered the question with the seriousness it deserved. Outside, the garden was doing its unhurried April work. The oaks were green. The lakes were catching the light. Wellington, who had been moved to a different field after the Rose incident but had escaped twice more since then, and showed no signs of reforming his character, was visible in the distance doing something inadvisable near the fence. Yes, she said. I think I am, she paused. I think I have been slowly for some time. She looked at him. He was watching her with the particular quality of attention that she had come to understand was, for Edmund Ashford, the equivalent of everything he did not say aloud. He was a man of considerable internal weather and a very calm exterior, and she had spent the winter learning to read the one through the other, and finding that the effort was without qualification, without reservation, entirely worthwhile. Thank you, she said. For all of it. You did most of it yourself, he said. You stayed, she said simply. He looked at her. Yes, he said. I did. In May, they updated the estate records. It was Edmund's suggestion, practically motivated, as his suggestions generally were. Because the estate records had not been properly maintained in a decade, and were in a state that he described as a moderate administrative crisis, and that Clara described as absolutely typical of my father. They worked through them together over the course of several evenings, at opposite ends of the desk with the lamp burning between them and the house quiet around them, and it was in the course of this work, ordinary, undramatic, entirely domestic, that Clara came across the original deed of sale. She almost missed it. It was filed between two household inventories and a letter about the drainage in the lower field, and she nearly turned past it before she registered what it was. She read it. She read the 12 pages. The manor house. The farmland. The lakes. The horses. Wellington. The wine cellar. The furniture. The debts. And then at the bottom of the final page, in handwriting so small it was almost invisible, one female, currently residing in the East Wing. Age 22. Status dependent. No arrangements have been made for her relocation. She sat with it for a moment. Then she took her pen. Very carefully, in her own clear handwriting, she drew a single line through the final entry. And beside it in the margin, she wrote four words. Edmund looked up from the ledger he was reviewing. What are you doing? He asked. Correcting an error, she said. He came around the desk and looked over her shoulder at what she had written. In the margin of the deed, beside the crossed-out entry in Clara Ashford's precise, unhurried hand, her name is Clara. He was quiet for a moment. Then he put his hand over hers on the desk, briefly, simply, in the manner of a man who knows when words are not the right instrument. Yes, he said. It is. The deed of sale was refiled in the estate records, where it remained. The manor house stood, as it had always stood, at the end of the long drive behind the oaks. The east wing no longer leaked. The library had been cataloged, dusted, and reorganized by someone who knew exactly where everything should go, because she had known this house since before she could read the names on the spines. The portrait of the little girl in the blue dress hung in the main gallery, beside the painting of the young woman reading in the garden, and beside those, added in the summer, by the same quiet hand that had arranged the rest, a small framed card on which someone had written, in careful letters, Clara Margaret Ashford, daughter of this house, home. Outside, in the field that bore his name, Wellington regarded the fence with the focused attention of an animal who has not yet run out of ideas. Spring moved through the estate in its unhurried way. The oaks stood as they had always stood. And in the library, with the window open and the April light coming in and the sound of the house around her house, her name, her life, finally and completely and irrevocably hers, Clara Ashford turned a page. And read. Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories.